From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Iraqi forces took control of the last ISIS stronghold in Ramadi. That, according to Sabah al-Numani, a spokesperson for the Baghdad government's counterterrorism units leading the fight. He told local television that the government complex in the western Iraqi city of Ramadi had been, quote, fully liberated and the Iraqi flag hoisted over the government complex, closed quote. The area was ISIS's last stronghold in the city, the capital of Anbar province, seized by ISIS militants in May after a week of fighting with government forces. CCTV's Inas Ibrahim reports from Baghdad.
Iraqis are celebrating the news of a progress in Ramadi. The people, especially the families of displacement people from Ramadi, they are celebrating in the streets the news of victory. But on the ground, there is still the fighting is continuing. There is still some pockets of resistance and also some suicide bombers and roadside bombs. Iraqi intelligence estimates the numbers of ISIS fighters in Ramadi about 400 fighters. Ramadi liberation has a significant victory. It is capital of Al-Anbar province, 110 kilometers west of Baghdad, and it is connect the road from Baghdad to Syria and Jordan. And after liberation of Ramadi will be handed to local police to control it.
On Monday, a major clearing effort was reportedly underway to allow Iraqi troops to move freely around the city after clearing the area of ISIS bombs and booby traps. According to reports, the city was seriously damaged during the fighting, with some districts completely destroyed by the army advance. Faleh al-Assawi, a regional council member of Anbar province, urged the government to start rebuilding the city quickly, citing the difficulties in getting families to return to a city lacking basic human needs. In Nigeria, at least 15 people were reported killed after Boko Haram gun and bombing attacks in a key northeastern city. The group attacked Jadaropolo, an area located on the outskirts of Borno State's capital, Maiduguri, on Sunday evening. Locals attending prayers at a mosque in the area said they heard the sound of gunfire and artillery rounds following evening prayers, and that residents fled their homes to other areas after the attacks. The siege ended after the Nigerian military responded with artillery fire. The attacks were the first by Boko Haram to be carried out in Maiduguri, the group's birthplace, in recent months. Boko Haram also killed at least 14 people after storming Kimba Village in Borno this past Friday. The recent attacks came days before Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's self-imposed deadline to uproot the group expires December 31st. Meanwhile, in comments issued last Wednesday, days before the expiration of the deadline, Buhari said that Nigeria has, quote, technically won, closed quote, the war against Boko Haram. At least 20,000 people have been killed and over 2.5 million people made homeless since the founding of Boko Haram in Nigeria in 2009. The group has expanded its attacks to neighboring African countries, which include Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. Elections set for this past Sunday in the Central African Republic were postponed for 3 days, that according to the UN mission in the country, MINUSCA. The vote was set to take place Sunday, December 27th, but will now be held Wednesday, December 30th. Voters will choose a president and representatives for the National Assembly as part of an ongoing transition process following nearly 3 years of fighting between Muslim and Christian groups, Deanne Penn reports.
The authorities in the Central African Republic postponed the elections in order to address logistical issues and to complete training for electoral agents, according to the UN mission in the country, MINUSCA. MINUSCA reports that the ballots arrived in the capital, Bangui, on Wednesday, which the UN operation will be delivering to the various provinces. Journalists in New York asked UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric if the postponement was a setback.
I would not characterize it as a setback. I think obviously given the very delicate security situation going on in the country, it's important that the elections take place in the best possible way. The peacekeeping mission will continue to assist with the distribution of ballots, and they will, of course, support the National Central African Forces. But this was a decision taken by the Central African electoral authorities themselves. It is their process, it is their elections to run, and we are there to support them.
Meanwhile, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration efforts in the country continue. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Protests continued into a second week in Argentina, with protesters being joined by rank-and-file journalists up in arms over Argentinian President Mauricio Macri's attempts to gut the country's media regulatory agency, charged with implementing the 2009 media law democratizing the press and reducing the concentration of media in a few hands. Critics charge the conservative Clarín Group, Argentina's largest media conglomerate, is behind Macri's move. Telesur's Laureano Ponce filed this report from Buenos Aires.
Argentine grassroots journalists are ready to fight a decree issued by President Mauricio Macri this week that could remove the head of Argentina's media regulation authority while gutting the institution. They say the resolution is undermining the country's six-year-old media law and that it will harm freedom of speech.
It is also a sad day for democracy for what this attack against the state by a media holding means. All that is happening, this way of stepping all over the media law, a law voted in Congress by most political parties, awarded as constitutional by the Supreme Court, after many years of junctions that allowed Clarín to avoid complying with the law.
Some of the country's most famous reporters, like Victor Hugo Morales, consider this a proof of the influence that Argentina's largest media holding, the Clarín Group, has in the new government.
All of this is now strengthened by an attitude that cannot be explained democratically by this group, which has managed to become part of the Sureca, the Clarín Group, and its CEO, Hector Magneto. Mauricio Macri's pro-party in the government and part of the judicial branch are totally obedient to the corporate power.
Community TV and radio stations and other alternative media that have received broadcasting licenses thanks to the country's media law approved in 2009 have also rejected Macri's move.
This is not just any piece of legislation that we are defending. This law was drafted through the most important participatory process in Argentinian history. There were thousands of people debating the law across the country and thousands in Congress. It is not acceptable that a party which has won the elections will now try to overrun institutionalism and the spirit of democracy.
Government officials have not ruled out the possibility to change the media legislation and to review the broadcasting licenses awarded so far thanks to the media law. This is seen by many as a move to favor Clarín's dominant position in the media market, which would seriously harm freedom of information.
For more on those protests in Argentina, and with a look at some of the news and events of the past year in Latin America and the Caribbean, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
Hi, Don. How are you doing? Everything all right up there?
Everything's fine. Survived Christmas thus far, so...
Well, good for you. That's an achievement on itself.
Yes, indeed.
And as you and I have discussed in previous programs, Macri has a very confrontational approach. And he's engaged in activities, for example, he's tried to nominate judges of his political stripe to the Supreme Court, but not via the normal legislative procedure, you know, ratification by the National Assembly and stuff like that. He's just tried to nominate them by decree. And another thing that he's tried to do by decree is to derogate the law on media, the media law that was passed by the Argentinian National Assembly, and that law essentially is a law designed to combat the concentration of media power in monopolistic corporate hands in Argentina, which is particularly irrelevant for the Clarín Group. The Clarín Group is a very well-known and, for people on the left, notorious media group vehemently opposed to any progressive initiatives, and they played a key role in the election campaign run by Mauricio Macri that was ultimately successful.
Of course.
At the end of November this year. So, and what he's done is he's tried to, by decree, shut down the government agency that was set up to implement the media law, and it's just, as far as I can see, and as my understanding of the Argentina's constitution, he's behaving in a way that is kind of either directly unconstitutional, or in a way that really pushes the envelope of what the power of the presidency is in Argentina. And that's an indication that our original assessment that Macri, he did his campaign in a kind of Barack Obama style, changey, hopey, very vague campaign promises style. And once he's got into power, he behaves in a way that he knows very well that Argentinian voters would have categorically rejected it in the election, because he projected a kind of moderate, mildly centre-right image. But in fact, his instincts and his behaviour have more in tune with the very worst behaviour of the Argentinian right wing, including the dictatorship. So a very prestigious writer in Argentina, a veteran journalist, Stella Coloni, now believes that Macri is going to try and govern by decree to roll back, and by decree roll back all the democratic legislation that has been established over the previous 10 to 12 years by Néstor Kirchner and his wife, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, over the last 12 years. So that's Stella Coloni's prediction. And Macri's actions to date seem to bear that out, which is extremely depressing for Argentina.
You know, what's interesting, he removed the head of the communications regulator, and he's been monkeying around with it and he's going to attempt to dismantle it. The this is sort of akin to the FCC in the United States in a way, and unlike here in the United States, where if somebody started meddling with the FCC, most people wouldn't know how to spell it. They're in the streets in Argentina over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's already provoking a response.
Yeah, and you see, and among the first measures that Macri took, and what the previous administrations had managed to do over the last 10 years, is to bring financial stability to Argentina's exchange rate, despite the attacks of the international finance system dominated by Wall Street. And what he did was dismantle that system that had worked very well, maintaining a stable exchange rate. And in effect, what happened was a more than 40% devaluation,
right,
of 40% the Argentine peso.
So like inflation, immediate inflation of like 40%.
Yeah, and imagine what would happen if the dollar declined by 40% overnight, right, in the United States. Yeah. What would happen to prices? Yeah. Well, that's what's happened in Argentina. Yeah. And that, it's all that stuff. Macri's campaign, and so far as I could gather from what I could follow of it from this distance, being in Nicaragua, Macri's campaign was a classic right-wing campaign, saying, the left-wing policies don't work. We're the ones that know how to manage economic policy. Trust us.
Like
we'll bring you a better life. And of course, it's a complete lie. And right-wing government after right-wing government have demonstrated that from the time of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan onwards. You know, and why did the great mass of people in the United States end up having to resort to credit in order to maintain their standard of living? Yeah. Because Ronald Reagan applied policies that crushed the buying power, the money power of ordinary people's wages in the United States. And that process was continued by Bill Clinton through the 90s. And that's what ultimately led to the crash of 2007-2008.
Right. When you have millions of good-paying jobs, tens of millions of good-paying jobs disappear from the economy, it has an impact on the buying power of the people in the economy. And when you don't do anything to protect local industry from global industries that really are nothing but exports of the local industries to places where they're not regulated, and they come back with cost-cutting, then you drive out those people that are hiring the remainder of the workforce here. You end up with the curve that you had in the labor market here that began in earnest with Reagan. It really began earlier than that.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, and it's the... That's what the right wing are doing in Argentina in a far more brutal way than a far more obvious way than the somewhat more subtle way that those same policies were applied in the United States and have been applied currently in an extremely brutal way, in an obvious way, in countries like Ireland and Greece. And that's, you know, when one looks at the things in a global context, the meaning of the progressive governments in Latin America has been that they present a bulwark against that whole right-wing process of driving down living standards for ordinary people. So yeah, and that's what's been happening in Argentina over the last couple of weeks, and then in Brazil, the very important developments in Brazil, where President Dilma Rousseff has been subject to a very, very cynical, ruthless attack by the right wing in Brazil's lower house of the Brazilian legislature, led by this character called Eduardo Cunha, who's the president of the lower house, and he himself is being investigated for corruption. And as we've mentioned in previous programs, he's an individual who has bank accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere, and even the Swiss bank authorities have frozen his accounts because of these corruption allegations against him in Brazil. But despite that, he's still kind of struggling on to try and carry forward his campaign to impeach Dilma Rousseff. Now, and we've mentioned this in the past, but over the year in Brazil, there were allegations that Dilma Rousseff and her predecessor Lula Ignacio da Silva, president of Brazil prior to Dilma Rousseff, were involved in corruption in the state oil company Petrobras, and those allegations were proved to be completely false and without merit. But now what Eduardo de Cunha is trying to do is to nitpick a constitutional wrinkle in Brazil that allows critics of the government to hold it to account for its budgetary management for the previous budgetary year. And that's what Eduardo de Cunha and his colleagues, his right-wing colleagues, have tried to do. They're trying to claim that Dilma Rousseff and her colleagues mismanaged the budget in 2014 and manipulated it for political purposes, which is, you know, put that in the context of the United States or the European Union, and it's just a complete joke, isn't it? I mean, that's what politicians do. But in any case, and the technical nitty-gritty is that Dilma Rousseff and her colleagues have a very strong defense against those charges. And the chances of now of Eduardo da Cunha's initiative being brought to a successful conclusion are very, very slim, because the Brazilian Supreme Court last week, either last week or the week before, I think it was last week, ruled that the procedure instigated by Eduardo da Cunha was unconstitutional, and that it was the higher house, the upper house of the Brazilian legislature, that has the final say about how any impeachment process is to be structured. And it is their vote that will decide whether Dilma Rousseff has a case to answer or not. And so Eduardo da Cunha is kind of really struggling against the current now. And it looks as though, and although he's full of bombast and then, you know, claiming that, you know, in 2016 he will carry through the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, and it's extremely unlikely that he'll be able to carry out that threat, and that he himself is likely to end up slung out of the Brazilian legislature for his own financial crimes, of which he's very clearly culpable. Right. Let's see, you know, and we obviously nobody knows what's going to happen, but that's what it looks like at the moment. And that's very, very important for Dilma Rousseff, because what she's trying to do now, very late in the day, it has to be said, is to reorient her government's economic policy. And she's fired the previous economy minister, who was a total disciple of classic neoliberal austerity. And she's put in a guy who used to be the Minister of Labour, who's also an economist, who has a much more kind of progressive take on the measures needed to cope with Brazil's very serious economic problems, caused mainly by the collapse in international commodity prices, and also by the ridiculous volatility of the corrupt international financial system dominated by Wall Street, the City of London, and Frankfurt. Most opinion in Brazil regard the attempt by Eduardo Cunha to be ill-starred from the start and bound to fail. And so, who knows? It's impossible that, and recent events in Venezuela, for example, and in Argentina have shown that it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen. And, you know, and that's, you know, it's such a trite observation, isn't it? But, and that's also the situation as regards what's happening in Brazil. So much depends on the configuration of support, the respective contending forces there. Dilma Rousseff's government, the progressive forces, the popular movement there, against the right-wing corporate conglomerations, the media conglomerations out there in Brazil. And it's a real battle, and that's something that's characterized the whole year, hasn't it? Throughout Latin America, there's been this battle for power, and people who talk about the conservative restoration, or people who still use this ridiculous term, the pink tide, and I think they're completely missing the point. And there's a constant struggle going on between the great mass of ordinary people who want a decent life, a sustainable life, a life that will enable them to pass on to their children a better nation, a better world, if you like. And the local oligarchies that are completely allied with the agenda of the global elites that dominate North America and Western Europe. And you can see the ebb and flow of it all. And for example, in Paraguay, a left-wing local government took power in took office at least in Asunción, the capital of Paraguay, but then in Colombia, in Bogota, and the left wing lost there largely as a result of its own corruption. And so what sense does it make to talk about pink tides and conservative restorations? You're talking about a whole series of very, very local battles that have all kinds of different characteristics that are extremely difficult to generalize about.
For sure. I mean, you mentioned Paraguay, for example. The way that the pushback happened there was through essentially a coup. And of course, in Honduras, that's what happened as well. And you have these various struggle tools, I guess, that are employed. We talk about Argentina. This is coming out of the presidential palace. In Venezuela, it's coming out of the National Assembly. They're replacing Supreme Court judges there. And, you know, they're looking to remake the society into a right-wing whatever. From the legislature rather than from the presidential palace. Rousseff, I'm thinking from what you mentioned before, noticed that perhaps the reaction of the Venezuelan electorate to moderation on the part of the president and the government is what led to their loss at the polls, and perhaps it's time to push ahead now instead of, accommodating the right. There's all these different permutations of activity among those who hold power and different levers of power.
Yeah, and so there's all that going on that makes a nonsense of attempts to generalize about, you know, processes that are happening continent-wide in Latin America and the Caribbean. On the other hand, look at what's happening in Colombia. Now, how does one categorize the peace negotiations there? Is that a capitulation of the left or a capitulation of the right?
Or maybe just how do you
characterize that? And one has to abandon the kind of political shorthands that people tend to use, that I myself tend to use, and when we're trying to understand the overall meaning of events, but when one's dealing like a process with the Colombian peace process, and you're dealing with something that's incredibly complex, and something that involves, and you could limit it to 60 years of history. Or you could then say, well, you know, this is a culmination of a process that has taken centuries to come about.
Yeah, right.
You know, and what is going to be the balance of power and what is going to be the political settlement in a country like Colombia that has been completely dominated by an elite that derived its power from the colonial era. Resisted attempts by the Gaitán in the progressive leader in after the Second World War to instigate reform, had him murdered, and then that reform process was kind of buried by the Colombian elites. And of course, what happened? There was a massive insurrection against that.
Of course.
Because, you know, you can't just repress this tremendous popular desire, this tremendous mass desire for social and economic justice. You can try to repress it, but eventually it's going to break free and demand that it's rightful place in national history and society.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.